All right. Joining us now is Marty Gottesfeld. And Marty's got a lot of different social media accounts. I was just asking where he is. He says he's trying to migrate everything to Substack, martyg.substack.com, where you can find his writing. Marty, and we've had Marty on. I actually had his wife, Dana, for many years while Marty was in a communications management unit. This is where they put political prisoners in the U.S. right now. It's where you will see Julian Assange heading. And so we want to talk to him about what life is like there. It's very, very difficult. It is there to manage and to shut off any communication to the outside world. And so that's what they've designed this thing for, and that's why they put dissidents and political prisoners there. We do have political prisoners, a lot of them, in the United States. So joining us now is Marty Gottesfeld. Thank you for joining us, Marty.
Thank you for having me, David.
Tell us a little bit about, just give us an overview of the CMU. We can get to your case in particular, but and why you were there. And of course, it was a great injustice. And I've talked many times to Dana about it, and we'll talk about that and things that are still happening with your court case. But you're out now. But tell us what the communication management unit is like.
So it's a small self-contained prison unit. Guys in the CMU do not get to go out to like the prison yard. They do not get to go out to the other places inside the prison that the average federal prisoner gets to go. They keep it self-contained in a very small area so that they can cramp down on communications, make sure that like you can't pass another prisoner a note or have another prisoner call somebody on your behalf, right? They keep even the laundry within the unit. The rest of the prison complex sends their laundry out, right, to like a central laundry place, but they're worried that, you know, it's just an example, prisoners will pass notes to the guys working in the laundry and then be able to get communications out that way. So they actually keep even the laundry, right, inside the unit. And like when you buy a commissary, right, for the most part, it's prisoners who pack the commissary bags, but not for CMU prisoners, only staff can pack a commissary bag for CMU prisoner, which, you know, sometimes makes it harder to even get your commissary if it's like a busy week, right? Like they might not have the staff to actually pack the bags for the CMU guys. When I got there April 1st, 2019 to the CMU in Terre Haute, Indiana, and there are two run by the Bureau of Prisons, which is a federal agency of the Justice Department, right? So the one is in Terre Haute, Indiana. That's the original facility. It was opened around 2006. During the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The wars provided the financial justification for the unit. The idea was that they would lock up like Al-Qaeda guys, jihadi guys there, and they would monitor their communications and they would mine those communications for intel to use in the war efforts. A few years later, they opened up a second communications management unit at the United States Penitentiary in Marion, Illinois. I spent about a year in that unit as well, so I've been to both CMUs. They justified the second unit as they didn't have enough room, in the first one. And after they'd been running the first one for a while, they had guys who had keep separate orders, right? Like they can't put this guy with that guy, or they'll attack each other on site. So they needed some place that they could, resolve those kinds of problems. The second unit basically doubled the CMU budget. The max capacity of either unit at any given time is about 50, 60 guys. When I first got there, they were running at about half that capacity. At any given time, there's probably a little fewer than half are, it's hard to even call them real terrorism cases, but they're at least cases that have some nexus to something cognizable as terrorism. There tend not to be the really high profile cases, though. The really high profile cases, they go to the supermax in the federal system in Florence, Colorado. So it's important to understand that these are not the only places where they can hold actual terrorists, right? Like El Chapo will never see a CMU. Right. He went from MCC New York, the high security lockup in Manhattan, right, straight to the supermax in Colorado. Right. So this is not where there's no justification to keep these units running for prisoners like that. This is where they put like you know, a 20-year-old kid who gets indoctrinated on the internet or gets entrapped by the Justice Department or both, who gets caught on like a plane to Syria or on like a cruise ship to Syria to try to fight on the other side of a geopolitical dispute, you know, in which the United States takes an interest, right? Those tend to be the so-called terrorism cases there. The Bureau of Prisons gets millions and millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars to run these units. They take prison guards with no intelligence training, with, you know, who would not be able to cut the mustard at State Department or CIA as intelligence analysts. And they label them intelligence analysts. They give them six-figure salaries. And then their job essentially becomes to give people like me and Julian a hard time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting. You said El Chapo, will you not find him there? I guess, would they send the Sackler family there for their opioid stuff? No, they're not going to go to any prison, right?
But those types of people, if they were in prison, right, it's a very real possibility. You know, I think I'm not trying to, hyperbolic, but, you know, if the feds were to lock up Trump, for instance, right, if any of these cases against Trump result in a prison term, you know, even a prison term pending appeal, I'm not saying, you know, that he wouldn't have appellate grounds or whatever, but if he does do any time in the federal system, a CMU is a likely place that Trump would go as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Keep him from communicating with the outside. They take away his cell phone to tweet with.
They're worried about his followers. They're worried about his supporters, right? He could make life very difficult on a CO if he were to say, you know, I have a problem with this particular CO, Mr. Smith. Right. The Bureau of Prisons would take very unkindly to that. Mm-hmm. And he'd likely find himself in a CMU.
And so, like so many other things, like the Patriot Act itself, we see something that is set up to house people that are violent terrorists. And instead, this thing then turns against, in many cases, people who are dissidents, people who are opposing their narrative, people who are political opponents. Schaefer Cox, for example, is mm-hmm. in one of these. He's not a terrorist.
So he's not
a threat of violence to anybody else, but they want to make sure that they cut off his communications because he has influence and he can influence people against the government narrative that they want to maintain. So Schaefer Cox, was he
and
there?
Not to mention a lot of his case was concocted.
Yeah.
He and I, we were a few doors down from each other. His case, it's almost laughable. I mean, and it would be laughable if they hadn't hemmed him up for so long on it. You know, the appellate court largely satirized his case when they reversed it and took away most of his sentence. And that was the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals. You know, it's a very liberal court that did not, you know, found the government's theory in that case, you know, kind of at the periphery of what a jury could reasonably convict under.
When we talk about Trump and lawfare and things like that, I mean, this has been going on for a very long time mm-hmm. other people like Schaefer Cox, but they have the ability to completely shut him down because he doesn't have a big following. He doesn't have $1 billion or several billion dollars. And so what they've done to him is horrific. And they put him into one of these communication management units that are there. Now, this is, as you were pointing out, you're not going to drive to Terre Haute, Indiana, and you're not going to see a sign out there that says communications management unit. Mm-hmm. It's a small part of the prison that is there and a small part of the one that is in Illinois as well, right? So this is a mm-hmm. subset of that.
Yeah, and so the Terre Haute CMU is actually the old federal death row. They built a new federal death row elsewhere in the compound, and then they used the old death row as the CMU. So, like, I've been inside Timothy McVeigh's cell. And then they leave up, like, some of the placarding from when it was the death row. And it's kind of like an ominous warning, like, keep doing stuff we don't like, and we're going to move you down. We'll find a way to concoct something and move you down the road.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's a lot of subtle coercion, right? You mentioned before that coercion is a form of force. And, you know, they have to try to maintain the appearance that, you know, there's a real public interest in running these units. And that's why, in my opinion, you do have the 30 to 45% kind of like terrorism material support cases that are there. Those are the excuse, right? Mm-hmm. And prisoners like myself, like Julian Assange, we are the real reason. Right? And so when you're there, like if you're me, right, when you're on the phone with a journalist, they just hang up the phone, take your phone away. If your wife quotes you to the press, which Dana did with me, you know, they throw you in solitary. I have all the paperwork to prove this. I've spoken recently in a few places about what Mr. Assange can expect to face in the CMU. And I think I was the federal prisoner with a course of conduct most similar to Mr. Assange's, because I was publishing, right? Very few guys in prison do, right? And Julian also, he does publish, right? They hate prisoner lawsuits out of the CMU, so they retaliate against any kind of litigation to uphold your First Amendment rights. You know, first they squelch your First Amendment rights, and then if you try to go to court, they retaliate against you further. Right. And I think that's something that Mr. Assange, unfortunately, can expect. When I was preparing to file a lawsuit, they said that my attempted lawsuit was extortion, and they threw me in solitary, even though courts all around the country have ruled that, you know, to try to say that litigation is extortion is frivolous, is patently frivolous. It doesn't matter, because no one is prepared in the Bureau of Prisons or in the local U.S. District Courts to be fair to you once you're placed in a CMU. Yeah. Unfortunately, in this country, most of our federal judges are former DOJ prosecutors, right? And they get spun that, you know, these are terrorists, this is the terrorism unit. So you're dead on arrival in court, you know, even before you get there, the courts aren't going to want to hear it. I'm out now. Before I was out, I had a federal habeas pending in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Indiana. It was fully briefed. It's been fully briefed now since July, and the court has not ruled on it, right? And I had pro bono counsel help me with that case. It's a very well-prepared case. And what they did, and under the rules and the statutes in the federal courts, federal habeas is supposed to jump to the front of the line. It's supposed to be the very first thing on which a court rules, because it affects somebody's liberty, right? And the liberty interest is one of the highest interests, if not the highest interest you can have in the law in this country. But if you're filing a habeas from a CMU, the court just doesn't rule on it until you're already out, and then they can say it's moot, you know, you're already out, but they avoid having any ruling, or they avoid having a majority of rulings that could go against the CMU on First Amendment grounds or on due process grounds, right?
This is something you filed while you were still a prisoner there. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And they still have not heard it, and as you expect, they're going to delay this and then say it's a moot issue?
That's par for the course, unfortunately. Yeah. But at the same time, you have a federal statute. We actually put it on the docket to the judge and asked him to rule. He said, look, under the rules, this is supposed to be the very first thing the court hears. Mm-hmm. And that we put that on the docket in, you know, a few months ago, and still nothing.
So let's, you know, and I want to get to your case and let you tell what happened with your case because you were there under these conditions and Dana was working very hard to get information out about this and to get the information about the way they abused your case, how you were a political prisoner. But do you think, you mentioned the Supermax prisons, do you think that they're going to send Julian Assange to the Supermax or to the CMU? And what is the difference between the two in terms of prisoner population?
Well, I think they'll send him to the CMU. The Justice Department has already made what I believe was an unqualified assurance to London that they would not, under any circumstances, send Assange to the Supermax, right? Mm-hmm. They've kind of said that they won't initially put him under what are called special administrative measures, or SAMs, which is kind of like the highest classification of communication restrictions a federal prisoner can be under. But you don't need to be under SAMs to be at the CMU. Like, I was never under SAMS. Yeah. But it's a distinction largely without a difference.
Right.
Right. Like, it doesn't, you don't need to be under SAMS. The problem for them with SAMS is it would cause a diplomatic uproar, and the Attorney General, the U.S. Attorney General, would actually personally have to sign off on it. Right. So there is some accountability there where he could later be questioned as to why he signed off on this communication restriction, whether it was constitutional, you know, all that. To put you in the CMU, they only need a sign off from the associate director of the Bureau of Prisons. Mm. It's nowhere near as high level an official. And those associate directors are like toilet paper. They get changed often pretty much for the same reasons. So, you know, it's way more likely that he will end up in a CMU. And they claim that the CMUs are general population units, that there's nothing atypical or significant about the hardships in the CMU. They've made these claims to the U.S. courts. The U.S. courts have largely credited those claims. The reality is, of course, though, it's not a general population.
Yeah.
Theoretically, I was supposed to get 2 15-minute phone calls each week while I was in the CMU. I was supposed to be allowed to call the media. And I didn't even get those, but compared to that, right, the average federal prisoner, depending on his or her exact circumstances, and this is in flux now with some of the prison reform stuff going on, but they get 300 to 500 telephone minutes per month, right? And CMU prisoners get at most 30 a week, and a lot of the times they don't even get that for various reasons. They can just lock the unit down without providing a reason and give no one their phone calls. And that goes on for days on end. Wow. If you miss your calls through no fault of your own, like if there's a technical issue with the equipment, which has happened, you just don't get your call, and there's no makeup call. You have no in-person contact visits. So in the CMU, whereas in the rest of federal prison, you have contact visits. So Dana was unable to hug me for 4 years. Mm. And then after NBC dropped the four-part docuseries on my case and Justina Pelletier, the Bureau of Prisons simply deleted Dana from my contact information, would not allow me to re-add her, never served me any paperwork to say that, I did anything wrong or Dana did anything wrong. And I was not able to speak to Dana for the last 7 or 8 months.
Wow.
That I was in the CMUs. And then when I was speaking with John Kiriakou, who is the CIA whistleblower who exposed the Bush torture program, I was discussing a different case that we'll get into that affects Operation Fast and Furious and the efforts to investigate Operation Fast and Furious. So I was talking with John. They clearly didn't like that. They heard Fast and Furious. They cut off my call with him. Would not let me call him again. I have a nephew who is an attorney, so he was kind of my last resort. I thought, okay, well, they really shouldn't mess with calls to a licensed attorney. My nephew was trying to help me with my case, trying to help me find counsel in the area. The calls were of legal nature. I was discussing the restrictions and when they had been applied and the facts upon which there are reasonable inferences of retaliation. A very similar set of circumstances to what, unfortunately, Mr. Assange can expect to experience himself. And they just cut off my calls to my nephew, wouldn't let me call him anymore. So for my last 7 months in the CMUs, I couldn't call anybody. They just deactivated my phone account. Wow. They never said that I broke a rule. They never gave me any kind of hearing of any kind. Right, and that's par for the course when you do things that upset them. Mm-hmm. But Dana quoted me to a reporter at RT, and RT ran an article with my quotes, right? And they took my phone away for 9 months and added 27 days to my sentence for being quoted by media. Right. Wow. And so these are just some examples, right? And this is unfortunately what Julian's gonna run into. And he's not the type to go quiet.
Yes.
Right, neither was I. And, right. And I get that. But unfortunately that means he's gonna run into this retaliation over and over and over again.
So they can make the pledge that he's not gonna be put in a supermax. They can say that he's not gonna get the special administrative things that
measures, Sam yes,
or whatever. Yes. Yeah. And yet, what they don't say is we're not going to put him in a CMU. What's that?
Well, no, they've not said they're not going to put him in a CMU.
Yeah, that's right. That's nobody knows about the CMU, really. It's that is not out there. And so it's like, oh, okay, well, I guess we got all the bases covered. No, they're not talking about the CMU. They're keeping that kind of quiet. And that's likely to be what he's going to get there. And so
just to give you an example, David, right? When I was in the CMU, the SAMS guys got their phone calls, but I did not, even though I was never on SAMS. During this period where they cut Dana and they just wouldn't let me speak on the phone at all, deactivated my phone account because I was talking about Fast and Furious, the guys on SAMS were all getting their phone.
Mm-hmm.
I was not, right? So they actually treated me harsher than the guys who were on SAMS, where they're arguably, and I think a lot of those cases are bogus too, but where there's arguably some national security basis, right? Where the U.S. Attorney General himself has signed off and said, this prisoner presents a national security threat. Those guys were getting their calls and I was not getting mine.
And the most amazing thing about it is, in your case, this was not, it wasn't an allegation of violence or national security threat or any of that kind of stuff. What it was a case of medical kidnapping that you worked to expose against Harvard's Children's Hospital. And because they're so heavily connected with government, they use the government to punish you for that, which is truly amazing. And I want to get to that as well. But you mentioned, and I want to talk about this Fast and Furious thing and what John Kiriakou was talking to you about. What is going on with the Fast and Furious? What is this information and how did you come by it?
So there's a prisoner in the Terre Haute CMU right now named Donald Reynolds Jr. And his case he didn't realize it at first. So he's a firearms collector. He was when he was out. He was a firearms collector. He had several historically significant pieces. He had a Browning from World War II. The government approached him, and they asked him to be an informant. And they had no leverage over him. He was not a criminal. It wasn't like they had him on something small or trying to turn him or anything like that. Uh-huh. So he refused, right? So the feds show up. They raid his house. They raid his parents' house. They find nothing. No drugs. All the firearms are legally licensed. He's got his Class 3 stamps, right? He's got his local permit. He's in compliance with state law, federal law, everything. But they concoct this drug case, this drug trafficking case against them, even though they've found no drugs. They've never found any drugs. And they use that to kind of silence him. As the years go by, they give him life plus 75.
Wow.
On this case. It's a first-time nonviolent offender with no drugs found. Get life plus 75. In comparison, El Chapo got life plus 15. Right. Uh-huh. So they actually gave Donnie a harsher sentence than El Chapo. As the years go by, Donnie starts putting stuff together, the names and dates in his case, right? And he went to trial. He forced them to go to trial like any innocent man would, or you would assume any innocent man would.
Yeah.
And he starts to realize that all the names and the dates overlap with Fast and Furious. And it took years for the information to come out, right? And so then I write about his case from inside the CMU, which was difficult to do, but I got it done. And the American Conservative did a months-long investigation. They published a feature under the headline, "The Knoxville Kingpin Who Wasn't." They go over all of Donnie's case. They go over all the names and the dates. They conclude in the end that this case is, you know, certainly adjacent to Fast and Furious. The names and the dates, everything lines up. And they recommend clemency for Donnie because of the prosecutorial irregularities. And they found several witnesses. I'm sure this doesn't surprise many in your audience, but it would surprise, I think, the average member of the public. They found several instances where federal prosecutors filed affidavits saying, this person told us X. Right? Or a federal agent says, this source claimed X. They then compared the trial testimony of these witnesses who sang a very different tune at trial, right? Mm. So either the prosecutor was lying or the source was never credible in the first place. And that's kind of the story of Donnie's case. And he's been fighting to try to get out, fighting to try to expose this. And they threw in a CMU and they retaliate against him viciously, right? And my theory on it is, you know, the U.S. House of Representatives during the Obama administration issued a subpoena to the White House for records on Operation Fast and Furious. Obama asserted executive privilege to quash that subpoena, and we never got the records from the White House about Fast and Furious. Fast and Furious, for those who don't know, the Justice Department allowed high-power, armor-penetrating firearms and ammunition to walk from the United States to the Mexican drug cartels. The Mexican drug cartels then used those firearms to massacre people, Mexican nationals, and also three federal agents were shot by these weapons. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. And that was actually something, I mean, just interject here. That was something that actually the Gunwalker program began under Bush.
And then it became
Fast and Furious under Obama. So it really is, you know, the ATF through both of these administrations, as we see over and over again, you know, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat that is in office, these same types of things are happening. And it was really to carry the water for the UN Arms Trade Treaty, which wanted to make a case that you had small arms that we would, you know, typically keep pistols and rifles and things like that. Small arms are going back and forth, creating this crime problem in Mexico. And the UN Arms Trade Treaty was saying, we got to stop that trafficking in arms across the border, which means that you're going to have to have every piece of firearms or ammunition or whatever identified and recorded in the United States. That was their end goal. That was the UN gun control move, the UN Arms Trade Treaty. And that's what this was all set up to support. And I think even the New York Times, after this all blew up when they had these federal agents get killed, I think even the New York Times said that this was a false flag. Everybody understood it was a false flag.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Donnie, right, he puts this all together and he's trying to get out. He's trying to get back into court. The Obama administration had the subpoenas quashed under executive privilege, right, which a president can claim whenever the U.S. Attorney General briefs him on a matter. It's analogous roughly to regular attorney-client privilege, except between the president and the Attorney General, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The problem for Donnie and for the Justice Department arises because Donnie's defense was entitled under the Fifth Amendment and under Brady v. Maryland. That's the discovery case where the government's got to turn over all of its evidence to your defense counsel, including evidence that speaks to your innocence, evidence that is not favorable to the prosecution. The prosecution doesn't just get to bury that. They have to turn it over to the defense. So this information was never turned over to Donnie's defense. Nothing about Fast and Furious was turned over to Donnie's defense. This is an appellate issue, right? If it's proven that they withheld this information, Donnie's conviction gets reversed. He gets to come back into court. And as long as his liberty is on the line, they cannot use executive privilege to quash Brady, because the liberty interest trumps the executive privilege interest. The congressional legislative interest does not trump executive privilege, but Donnie's liberty interest does. Mm-hmm. Right? And so if he ever gets back into court, they're either going to have to drop the case or the truth about Fast and Furious is going to come out. Right? And so he, like myself and I fear Julian Assange, right? This is a great example of the type of case that's in the CMU that there's no purpose to protect the public. There's no public safety interest. There's no compelling interest to protect prison authorities. Donnie has never been violent. He's not accused of violence. But they'll use the CMU in his case and in Julian's case and in my case and in Schaefer Cox's case. And there's another gentleman there named Kurt Johnson. Kurt's a great guy. He interceded to stop a murder in the CMU after there had already been one murder. There was going to be a second, and Mr. Johnson stepped in and stopped it. He was suing big banks on behalf of homeowners in 2008 before the financial crisis, saying that the loans were predatory and invalid.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
He gets sentenced, you know, a few months before the crisis, everything hits the fan. Right. And if his case had been a few months later, maybe it would work out very differently. Mm-hmm. Right, but that's another guy who's there in the CMU, and it would be very embarrassing for the system. And you know who went to jail over the 2008 financial crisis? The whistleblower.
That's right. Right?
Only the whistleblower went to prison. Right. Yeah. So these are the types of cases that are in the CMUs.
Wow. Wow. And of course, John Kiriakou, the whistleblower about the CIA torture, did they not have the CMUs at that point in time? I know, where did they put him when he was in jail?
So he has written, I'm not allowed to have any direct communication with Mr. Kiriakou since I'm still on supervised release, right? Okay. So I have to preface with that, right? But I do recall that while I was on my way to the CMU, Mr. Kiriakou wrote about my case, and he said that he had been placed in a modified CMU at FCI Loretta Pena. And I have not heard that there was a modified CMU there. No one else that I know of has heard about that. But given that he was CIA, it's certainly possible, if not likely, that they did something very special with him, even by CMU standards.
Oh yeah, yeah, they probably. Yeah, they probably did their own, it got its own individualized CMU just for him. That's probably exactly what happened. Well, let's talk a little bit about your case, because I think it's interesting to see the links that they will go to put somebody in and to severely restrict their communications, to punish you, as you pointed out, if somebody does an article about you or you have a communication, you were trying to, you were able to kind of in some of your legal proceedings, you're able to get some information out that way to your wife, but they pretty much kept everything, excuse me, about to sneeze there. They pretty much kept everything under control. And tell us a little bit about why you got there, because it truly is, your case is truly astounding. You are not a threat to anyone other than a very highly politically connected and very powerful, wealthy organization. And so we could see this type of thing happening, for example, if somebody were to expose and be a whistleblower about Pfizer or something like that, right? Because these people are very highly, it doesn't even have to be a health issue. It could be any kind of a whistleblower who is exposing information about a politically connected organization or corporation. So tell us a little bit about the background of your case.
So there was at the time she was 14 years old, a girl named Justina Pelletier. She has mitochondrial disease, which is a congenital genetic condition that's degenerative, progressive, and sadly often fatal. It's the same condition that baby Charlie Gard had, or actually the same type of condition that baby Charlie Gard had in the UK. And there was a more recent instance of another child in the UK who had this condition and they effectively just pulled the plug on them. They would not allow the parents to seek experimental therapies to try to help these kids. Justina has a slightly more survivable form of it. Mitochondrial disease is like an umbrella term for a bunch of different genetic disorders. So no two cases are really the same. Her gastroenterologist had moved from Tufts University Medical Center to Harvard's Boston Children's Hospital, and Justina caught the flu. And the flu causes severe complications for mitochondrial disease patients because mito is a metabolic disorder. Your cells in your body have a hard time converting food into chemical energy to run the body's systems. So then when the patient gets the flu and has nausea and has a hard time eating, right, you're compounding this metabolic problem because, you know, the food that was getting in already had a hard time being converted to energy. Now you're stopping the food from getting in the first place, right? Mm-hmm. So her primary mito doctor, a renowned guy named Dr. Corson at Tufts, refers Justina to see her gastroenterologist who, you know, the month before was working at Tufts. And this would have been no problem. She would have gone right into Tufts and seen him. But he had moved to Boston Children's Hospital, I think it was to pursue a grant. So he refers her to Boston Children's Hospital to see her gastroenterologist. This is a doctor who had been with her for years. This gastroenterologist had actually operated on her to put in a cystectomy tube to help her use the bathroom. But she gets to Boston Children's Hospital via ambulance like 3 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday during a blizzard. The gastroenterologist is not there. She gets seen by a young neurologist a few months out of his medical training. He doesn't believe that Justina has mitochondrial disease. He refers the parents for medical child abuse, basically Munchausen syndrome by proxy, where the, you know, his theory effectively it seemed to be that Justina's parents were seeking attention and making her sick just to kind of bring attention onto themselves. It ignored the diagnosis. It ignored the fact that Justina's older sister also had mito and was successfully treated for mito. And again, this is a genetic condition, so it tends to run in families. It tends to be passed down the maternal line. Mm-hmm. So he either didn't know or ignored those facts, sent Justina for a form of psychological therapy for what they call somatoform disorder, or like psychosomatic disorder, where like you think you're sick, and your brain then kind of makes you sick, or your symptoms fit your own perception of your illness, right? They took Justina off all her mito treatments, right? And that was when her parents, you know, really expressed severe alarm, because again, this is a degenerative and often fatal illness. You take her off of her treatments, there's going to be severe repercussions. And we've seen that there in fact were. You know, she was walking. She could at least feel her legs when she walked into Boston Children's Hospital. She was having some trouble ambulating because of the flu and the lack of energy. But, you know, she was ice skating 6 weeks earlier.
Yeah, right? I remember seeing the pictures of her in skates. Yeah. Yeah.
Now she's crippled. Now she can't walk, right? Wow. And it's because they took her, in my view, because they took her off of these mito therapies. And we don't know if she'll ever walk again, unfortunately.
Wow.
So at the height of this case, right, the government alleges that I launched the largest distributed denial of service attack, a DDoS attack that they had ever seen. That I basically sent too much
web traffic. Let me interject here for a second, because this went on for quite some time, and she's degenerating throughout all of this.
Yeah, this went on for over a year.
A clear case of medical kidnapping, and there's been other allegations of medical kidnapping by other people over and over again from this particular institution. And so this has gone on for quite some time before allegations came out. But go ahead.
They had a word for it at Boston Children's Hospital. They called it a parodectomy. Like an appendectomy is removal of the appendix, a hysterectomy is removal of the uterus, right? Like a parodectomy, removal of the parents, right? Wow. That's what these doctors called it. That came out of the Boston Globe.
Wow.
And at one point, so Boston Children's Hospital is monitoring, or between Boston Children's Hospital and the state, they're monitoring Justina's communications. They're clamping down on Justina's communications. It was almost like she was in her own little CMU inside Boston Children's Hospital.
Yeah.
She couldn't discuss her care or treatment with her parents, or they would terminate the call or terminate the visit. They limited the parents to one 20-minute phone call a week and I think one in-person visit for like 40 minutes or an hour or something like that. And again, control the topics of conversation to prevent anything from getting out. They would not allow the parents to photograph Justina, so they couldn't document, right, and show the public that she was deteriorating.
Wow.
Right, they couldn't show the public what she looked like now versus what she looked like before. Right, so at the kind of the height of this, Justina's parents published a handwritten note by Justina where she talked about the kinds of things that the psych ward people had done to her, right? And it was, they hurt me all the time. They don't let me sleep very much. Please hurry. Mm-hmm. Right. And so like that note comes out like the day before the government alleges I launched this huge distributed denial of service. And basically the charges against me amount to sending too much internet traffic at somebody's network. Right. That's what we're talking about. They never claimed that I compromised any patient information, that I ever penetrated the system, broke into anything.
That's right.
You know, did anything. What I did was I took down their donation portal.
That's right. That was the allegation. Taking down their donation. Yeah, taking down their donation thing. Not that anybody was harmed by this, but just taking down their donation thing during a fundraiser event.
Well, they alleged that people were harmed or could have been harmed, but the jury wouldn't convict on it. Ah. When all the facts were aired in court, they did not obtain a conviction. They tried, under the federal law, the bar is so low for them. All they had to prove was that I potentially, not even actually, but potentially impacted the medical diagnosis, treatment, or care of one individual. And they couldn't meet that bar. They failed to meet that bar. In federal court with a pro-government judge.
Yeah.
Right? Wow. Right? Literally everything going for them. And they would not allow me to plead defense of another. Like if I'm in a dark alley and I see someone being attacked,
yes.
You know, with a knife or with a gun, right? And I shoot the assailant, right? And then they charge me with murder, right? In the United States, you're supposed to be able to plead defense of another, right? It's just like self-defense. If someone were to attack you and you were to take action to defend your own life, if someone were to attack your wife and you took action to defend your wife's life, or if someone were to attack your child and you were to take action to defend your child's life, right? Mm-hmm. So they just wouldn't let me argue that. They took it away. They took it out of the jury's purview. They told the jury instead that my good motive was no excuse for the crimes charged.
Wow.
Right. And then we find out that the federal judge who sits on my case is a clerk, shareholder, director of a for-profit family seafood business called Slade Gorton & Co. Inc. That Slade Gorton & Co. Inc. donates to Boston Children's Hospital. That Boston Children's Hospital publicly thanks Slade Gorton & Co. Inc. on the very same website the government alleges I brought down. We find out that the Harvard hospitals that were all allegedly affected by the DDoS do industry research for Slade Gorton & Co. Inc. and an industry trade group called the Seafood Nutrition Partnership to market the company's products to the public as heart healthy. We find out that the judge was a board member and a member of the corporation of an organization called the New England Home for Little Wanderers, that his brother was also a board member of this organization, and that this organization, since 2003, is partnered with Boston Children's Hospital to divert juvenile psychiatric inpatients to outpatient stay, which is what they were trying to do with Justina as soon as she became hot potato, right? Wow. And then we find out that one of my jurors in this case, from a jury that was supposedly drawn randomly, was an accountant for the Home for Little Wanderers. And she steps forward on the first day of trial and says, hey, I was an accountant for the New England Home for Little Wanderers. I'm worried this might cause a mistrial. Yeah. And we move to dismiss this juror, and the judge refuses. And the judge never discloses, and he never discloses that he was a board member at the New England Home for Little Wanderers. Then we find out that the first witness in the case, the government's first witness, was a contractor with an agency that actually did the IT work for the New England Home for Little Wanderers.
Wow.
And the judge never discloses this and never recuses from the case. Right. And the number of connections, I mean, this is just scratching the surface in my case. And I have all the documents to prove it. And you mentioned that there's a new filing in my case. I've moved to vacate the conviction. You get one chance after your appeals are done, you get one further chance under federal law to attack the conviction. And I've moved to do that, and the filing is pending in the U.S. District Court in Boston right now. But unfortunately, it's pending before the very same district judge, the same person with all these conflicts of interest gets to decide, you know, whether the conviction should be overturned.
Wow. And when we look at Julian Assange, I didn't get into this earlier in the program, but the judge, well, there's two judges that are presiding over this thing. One of these two judges has a very, very long history with British intelligence, the Ministry of Defense. He has even been involved in enhanced interrogation cases and things like that, just like
John Rizzo that I mentioned.
Yeah. And so, I mean, he's got a very, very long history with the very people who are coming after Julian Assange, just like this judge in your case.
And Assange will be tried in the Eastern District of Virginia over here in the United States. That's the jurisdiction where they indicted him. That's known as the intelligence court. Right. To people like John Kiriakou, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, right? That's where they bring all these intelligence cases. And basically your jury pool is Alexandria, Virginia. Your jury pool is, you know, pulling from these very same federal agencies. And the U.S. judges, unfortunately, they don't disclose largely. The Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago published a front page expose. They found that 131 U.S. federal judges had presided over 650 cases in which the judge owned an equity interest in one of the parties. So that's like Microsoft sues Amazon, the judge owns stock in Microsoft, and the judge does not disclose, right, and does not recuse himself, right? And to put that into perspective, because the Wall Street Journal, I don't know why they didn't, they never did. The U.S. doesn't have that many federal judges. 131 federal judges is about 1/6. Mm-hmm. It's about 1/6 of the federal judges. So with a very, less than comprehensive. I mean, it was good work that the Wall Street Journal did. I'm not trying to impugn it, but their search was just like surface level, right? Yeah. And with a comprehensive, in that they went over every judge's disclosures, but they didn't look too deeply into, you know, each particular judge's situation. They found that 1/6 U.S. judges broke the law when it comes to recusal.
Wow.
Now imagine what a deeper analysis would do. And imagine Julian's judges in the Eastern District of Virginia, right, who likely have serious ties to these contractors, likely own equity and stock, right, in companies like Northrop Grumman, right, and the other defense contractors, right, mm-hmm. the people who sold the tanks, right, the people who sell the weapons, you know, to the military, and you know, Julian arguably cost him a lot of business because he made it a lot harder to continue to prosecute the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They lost a lot of money,
yeah,
because of his reporting.
Yeah, well, it truly is amazing. And of course, you're talking about a surface looking at conflict of interest. They wouldn't have probably discovered the kind of connections that you discovered with this judge if they just did a surface analysis.
Exactly,
that was a couple of different levels deeper than just the surface.
Yeah, and that's exactly my point. They discourage attorneys from looking into these issues. And most attorneys, like my attorneys, would not file to recuse my district judge. They feared him so much. They feared retaliation from him. At least that's the only logical explanation that I was ever able to conjure, was that they fear this guy so much, they will not brief the issue. And so I was left to do it pro se. And then, you know, if you brief something like this unrepresented, they try to act like you're some crackpot, right? Like the lawyer who has himself for a client is a fool, right? Mm-hmm. But like at the same time, like they make sure that none of the court appointed attorneys are ever going to brief this. They make it very unlikely that even a private retained attorney would ever brief this. And then you try to brief it yourself, even if you have all the documents, all the evidence, right? They say you're some wingnut because you represent yourself.
Well, you really are a fighter, and it is truly, I'm sorry for what happened to you, but how long were you in? You went into the Supermax in 2019, so you were there a little bit less than 5 years. How long were you in that, not the Supermax, the CMU?
I was never in the Supermax. Yeah.
How long were you incarcerated for?
Sure. So I was in the CMUs one way or another from April 1st, 2019 to June 9th. Of 2023. So a little more than 4 years. I was split between the two facilities. I did time in both. I've seen both. There are some meaningful differences, but nothing really that, you know, would affect Julian or nothing that would affect his extradition case, right? Mm-hmm. Like the bottom line is they're going to put him in one of these units. They're going to do so for unconstitutional reasons. They're going to violate his constitutional rights. There's really no reason that Britain should extradite him. And there is no representation from the U.S. government that is credible, right, in terms of preserving his rights. And if we're just real here, he's only being prosecuted because he told the truth.
That's right. Right.
And people found that embarrassing, and it went against, you know, powered, moneyed interests. And there used to be a time, I feel, in this country where that wouldn't be an issue, where they wouldn't be able to go after you like this. And right. With Assange in particular, right, they agonized over whether to bring this case because, you know, the ramifications of it. The Obama administration, they called it the New York Times problem. Like, how are they going to justify prosecuting Assange? but not prosecuting the New York Times. Mm-hmm. And the thing is now they're just very selective. The federal laws are written in such a way that they can pick on anybody.
That's right.
Right. It's like,
well, what we're starting to see is in the UK, they said, well, if you're an accredited organization, you know, you get a different standard. So we have a dual standard for so-called non-accredited, non-establishment media than there is for other people and for anybody who is exercising their free speech. And as Ed Snowden pointed out, he said what he's being accused of are crimes against a state. And the extradition treaty between the U.S. and the U.K. Specifically excludes somebody from being extradited for crimes against the state.
Most extradition treaties have carve-outs for political offenses or for that kind of thing. Right. That's something that you expect to see in an extradition treaty.
Yeah. And yet what we have now is all of the Western governments are rapidly moving towards criminalizing dissent. And that is what's so concerning about this. They're moving against the press, the independent press. They're moving against individuals exercising their free speech. But it is all about criminalizing dissent and criminalizing information. It's not enough for them to ban people. It's not enough for them to financially deprogram people. They have to now move to criminal penalties. We see this happening throughout Europe. There's the movement towards this in the U.S. as well. It's a very foreboding harbinger of what is on its way when they can do this to Julian Assange. And you point out the New York Times problem. Going back to the New York Times and the Washington Post and Pentagon Papers, they didn't come after the press people. It's one of the reasons why they're alleging that he had incentivized somebody to get these papers. And that's so tenuous what they're coming after him for. It's pretty transparent that this is political persecution.
Yeah, I mean, what journalist would not encourage a source to come forward? And how explicit does that encouragement have to become before it's a problem? You know, under the conspiracy laws of the United States, even a tacit agreement, they call it, an unspoken tacit agreement is enough to find a conspiracy. So under this theory, really any journalist who runs a secure Dropbox, right, could be said to be tacitly encouraging people to violate the classification, the Espionage Act, right? And so, it's a very slippery slope. I agree wholeheartedly with your comment about the way dissent is being criminalized. And I think it really, on the other side of it, right, it shows that, for the most part, these government narratives are so weak, so flawed, that they know they cannot stand the scrutiny.
Yeah.
When you feel truly confident about your perspective, about what you're doing, your actions, right? You don't mind the scrutiny. It never bothers me to get a tough interview question about Justina, about like, what if this had done, like whatever. I'll answer those questions. I don't mind being in the hot seat and answering a difficult question because I truly believe in what I did. I think it passes muster, right? But when you know your argument is weak, that's when you can't have people question it.
That's right. And we've seen this with the so-called science behind climate change, the so-called science behind the pandemic and everything. Oh, you can't see my data. I'm not going to, you dare not question me about this. And so immediately when somebody shuts this thing down and they don't want to show you their data, if they're talking about science, or they want to shut down anything that is about dissent and claim national security of some sort, we know exactly what is happening with it. And as you point out, they're very fearful about this. They understand how weak they are in this, but it is also something that makes them a lot more dangerous because they're going to start lashing out in new ways against people in terms of punishments and even imprisonment for this. And it is really sad to see how every aspect of the First Amendment is actually being just trashed and shredded with these actions.
Yeah, and if they succeed in expediting Assange, right?
Yeah.
Then the message really is that they can get any whistleblower anywhere.
Yes.
Right. This is a test case, right? Like if they succeed in getting him, right, that means that they can get you in the UK, all the Commonwealth nations, they can get you anywhere in Asia, they can get anywhere where they have influence, anywhere where they're able to hold aid or cooperation or any of these kind of unilateral or bilateral diplomatic arrangements, right? And the U.S. does. We buy influence all over the world. You know, all that aid we give, we don't do it out of the goodness of our hearts. And you know, we do that to buy influence. And, you know, at the same time, you have the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Like, I can't bribe a customs agent. You know, if I go on vacation at the Bahamas and I'm bringing in some liquor or something I'm not supposed to bring in, if I slip the guy a 20, right, I've committed a felony. I've violated the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. But if the U.S. government gives some country $1 billion worth of aid, say to fire a prosecutor looking into, you know, someone's son,
yeah,
that's perfectly legal. that's perfectly legal.
Yeah.
So I go with the 20, I'm going to prison. He does it with the billion, that 20 of my own money, on which I paid taxes.
Yeah.
I'm going to prison.
That's right.
He does it with $1 billion of our money. And, you know, don't you dare ask.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's amazing that the double standards and just the corruption, the ruthlessness as we turn more and more authoritarian. In terms of what is happening with your case now, you got this action that is pending there. Is that I know that Kiriakou served his time and was released. He wanted to get a pardon because if you got a criminal record that limits you to doing certain things, certain activities. In his particular case, it was keeping him from getting his pension. And of course, the interesting story that he had about Rudy Giuliani wanting a couple of $1 million to do that for him with Donald Trump. But apart from that, I mean, is that in play with the filings that you have there? Is that part of it?
So clemency comes later, or usually comes later. It can be granted at any time, but one of the arguments they try to use against you when you go for a pardon, right, is that you have to exhaust everything in the courts, right? They're not trying to preempt the courts generally, right? Right. The president has the prerogative to do whatever he wants, but the kind of accepted practice going back many decades is first you exhaust everything in the courts. You give the courts the opportunity to do what's right, right? So I'm still kind of at that stage. But if this fails, then yes, the next thing up would be a pardon. I feel I'm a good candidate for that, especially given what happened to Justina, what Boston Children's Hospital has been seen doing after Justina. They really have kind of committed themselves as a partisan political organ. That comes with benefits to the institution, but it also comes, also has other ramifications, right? Which means that, you know, my case might be viewed in a partisan light because of the partisanship of this of the other actor. So yeah, I mean, my effort or my focus first and foremost has to be the litigation, at least for now, and then we'll see what happens after that.
Well, I certainly wish you the best with that, and I appreciate your tireless efforts to help other people in the CMU that are unjustly convicted, that are political prisoners, to expose this kind of incarceration that is directed towards political prisoners, enemies of the state, for whatever reason. And we've seen this net continue to get wider and wider, going after parents who speak out at a school board meeting, for example. It is absolutely insane to see the way they are extending these borders of people that they allege to be threats to them, extremists, terrorists, and all the rest of this stuff.
They have no other way to support their policies. They have nothing else.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. They are desperate. And so people can find you again at Substack, MartyG.substack.com. And of course, while you were still incarcerated, your wife, Dana, ran a lot of social media platforms on Facebook and other places that were under Free Marty G. And those are still available as well. People can find you also on Twitter at Marty Gottesfeld, GOTTESFELD. But again, MartyG.substack.com is really probably the best place for people to find you, isn't it?
Because the new flagship. Yeah, the new flagship.
Okay. Yes, good.
Thank you, David.
Thank you so much, Marty. Thank you for the work that you do. It is very important. People need to understand what is happening with us.
The David Knight Show is a critical thinking super spreader. If you've been exposed to logic by listening to the David Knight Show, please do your part and try not to spread it. Financial support or simply telling others about the show causes this dangerous information to spread farther. People have to trust me. I mean, trust the science. Wear your mask, take your vaccine, don't ask questions.
Using free speech to free minds, it's the David Knight Show.